House Resources Committee is called to order at 1:02 p.m. on Monday, February 20th, 2023. We are meeting in Capitol Room 124. Present are Representative Mears, Representative Armstrong, Representative McCabe, Representative Sadler, and Representative Rauscher by phone, and myself, Chairman Tom McKay. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to do business. Let's see, I'd like to thank our recorder, Justin, and our moderator, Zach, and committee aide, Ed King, for helping keep everything in order today. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones. I will now bring HB 50, carbon storage, back before the committee. This is the fourth hearing on HB 50. I plan to open public testimony here momentarily. We will give testifiers 3 minutes to testify today. We will try to finish by 2 o'clock, and then we will have our consultant today with Stantec give a presentation at that point. So with that, I will open public testimony. Public testimony is now open on HB 50. Please keep your comments to under 3 minutes. Ed King will keep the clock. I'd also note that we will accept written testimony delivered to house.resources at akledge.gov. That's house.resources at akledge.gov. With that, I will go to the first. Is there anyone present that wishes to testify in the room? Seeing none, we will now go to people that are online to testify. First up, I have Lydia Shoemaker from Wasilla. So, Lydia, can you hear me?
Yes. Hi. Thank you.
Okay, Lydia, please state your name, your affiliation, and begin your testimony.
My name is Lydia Shoemaker. I am just a concerned citizen, and I live in Wasilla. Today I am calling in to testify in opposition of HB 50. I am going to be specifically addressing page 18, section 31, line 31. It references implementing this framework, quote, for the purpose of protecting health, safety, and property in the state. It is in the public best interest that to the extent economically and technologically feasible, carbon dioxide be injected, et cetera, end quote. CCUS, carbon capture, utilization, and storage is not economical. In Illinois, Archer Daniels Midland, one of the world's largest agribusiness companies, spokeswoman Jackie Anderson explained that the total carbon capture and storage work at ADM is valued at $441 million, of which $281 million came from the Department of Energy, so federal tax dollars, and the project employed 11 people. Joining a fiat currency and hoping for a carbon currency once the 45Q tax credit ends is not economical. In fact, costing the taxpayers $281 million for one attempt at carbon capture also affects the health and safety of Alaskans. We all know that natural resources are vital to Alaskans, and as the cost of natural resources increases, it will be on the cost of the citizens' health, safety, and property. Carbon capture projects cost more to the citizen than if we were to just continue operating as we are with the oil and gas industry. Having an increase of expense on all Alaskans is something that is a very large struggle for everybody. If your heating, for example, in California, they follow some of the same principles, and their heating bill increased by threefold. Having everybody in Alaska's heating bill and energy increase like that is a safety and health concern, as we do have, obviously, very cold winters, and that is something that's critical for the citizens of the people, or the citizens of the state. I thank you for hearing my testimony, and I just want to reiterate that I am in opposition of HB 50, and I thank you for your consideration.
Okay, thank you, Lydia. You said it kind of fast. Could you please repeat the section that you were concerned with, that you mentioned at the beginning?
Specifically, it's addressing page 18, section 31, line 31 is where it starts, and it does go on to page 19 under policy on carbon dioxide storage.
Okay, thank you, Lydia, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Okay, now we will move to Mr. Ken Griffin in Anchorage. Ken, can you hear me? Hello, Ken. All right.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, Mr. Ken Griffin.
There we are. Hello. Thank you for your time. I appreciate that.
Okay, Ken, please state your name, your affiliation, and begin your testimony. You have 3 minutes.
My affiliation comes in the fact that I'm a citizen of Alaska. That's it. My name is Ken Griffin, and currently I'm in Anchorage right now.
Okay, please begin your testimony.
Okay. Yes. In my opinion, of everything I read and research from the testimony of the people that have come before this committee, from all the examples that we have of carbon capture storage utilization, this will be a financial disaster for the state. It will take money, as your own testimony, as the people have testified in your own committee, this will take money out of the hands of the taxpayer and move it over to the government side. It will be cost both the consumer and the taxpayer money at the expense of the citizen. It will grow government, but not the economy. There is no project of carbon capture utilization that is currently profitable and working, which means that it can only be subsidized by the government, which really means by the taxpayer. This will cost the taxpayer money. That's less money for fuel. That's less money for groceries in an already terrible economic climate. Inflation is rampant. Most Alaskans can't even afford the basic needs. We make far more money with oil and gas. Every project that I've seen in this whole arena of carbon capture and utilization has been a failure. Chevron alone in its Gorgon plant in 2021 fell shy 5 million tons and had to pay a $300 million carbon tax credit. There is no way for the technology does not exist to make this economical and feasible. We need other projects that are going to help the economy grow. This will not help the economy grow. And the most important thing that we have here is that the economy grows and the government grows at the same time, not just one or the other. And I want to end on this note. Cicero himself said that a citizen cannot be a citizen without ownership of private property. It's what creates respect between man and law. And I think that always legislators should be pushing in the direction of creating respect between man and law by helping to grow the economy so that we may support government, not the other way around. It's very crucial, in my opinion, that if you don't want to end this program, you at a minimum shelve it so we can do a proper economic impact study, both environmentally and on the economy. The numbers aren't adding up. And so far, that from all the testimony I could see and all the examples that I've read when it comes to carbon capture and storage, there's no economic viability in this program unless it's subsidized by the taxpayer. I shouldn't, as a state of Alaska, we should not have to take money from the taxpayer to sell our products to market. That's not feasible. That's my half.
Okay, thank you for your testimony, Mr. Griffin. Moving on, Mr. Anthony Panino, I'm sorry, I want to make sure I said it right. Anthony, can you hear me?
Good afternoon. You said my name absolutely correct. I appreciate that.
Okay, Anthony, please state your name again. Tell us your affiliation and begin your testimony.
Sure. My name's Anthony Panino. I'm a resident of Anchorage. I'm representing myself in this testimony, although I am associated with the CCS Working Group for the state of Alaska. So I'm a lifelong Alaskan resident. I've worked projects on the North Slope off and on for 25 years on a variety of different projects. And I am in favor of HB 50 for a variety of different reasons. One is I think it's a good way to actually increase oil and gas development on the North Slope due to a variety of different methodologies around CCUS, whether that be the decarbonization of the oil and gas that's actually developed, creation of carbon credits, scope one emission reductions for operators on the North Slope, and also bringing in new industries as well on the North Slope due to potential creation of decarbonized electricity due to carbon capture from monetizing our natural gas on the North Slope. I've actually worked on CCUS projects in the lower 48, so I know that they can be successful. And I think the opportunities in Alaska, particularly on the North Slope, are just immense. And I think it will be a benefit to the existing oil and gas industry and not a competition or competitor in terms of how the economics will work.
Okay. Are you finished, Anthony?
I'm finished. I don't want to take up all my time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for testifying. I'd like to note that Representative Puckettuck joined us at approximately 1:08 p.m. Okay, moving on. John Hentges. Hentges, John, can you hear me?
Hello. Thank you for the opportunity today. My name is John Hentges. So you got really close. People really, really struggle with my last name. I appreciate how close you got.
Okay.
And thank you for the opportunity to comment today. I'd like to start off by commending Haley Payne, Frank Passman, and Christy Ressler.
Yeah, John, what is your affiliation, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. I work for a company called Storegga, and they're based in the United Kingdom and do carbon sequestration over there. But I'm calling in today as a private citizen.
Okay. Please begin your testimony. 3 minutes.
I'd like to thank Haley Payne, Frank Passman, and Christy Ressler. They led the working group, the state working group that provided input into the bill that's in front of you today. The group had over 50 members, including nonprofits and non-governmental organizations. Corporations were represented, as were universities, state, and federal agencies, as well as members of the public. We met every few weeks for several months, and the meetings were collaborative and interactive. I actually attended most of the meetings, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to participate. As I said, my name is John Hentges, and I'm currently the Alaska Project Manager for Storegga. Storegga is based in the United Kingdom. As part of the previously mentioned industry work group that was led by Frank Passman and others, Storegga has been working with the Alaska DNR to share lessons regarding approaches to carbon storage regulations in other parts of the world. Storegga has been operating in this space for quite some time in Europe. Me personally, I have lived in Alaska for over 23 years, and it's actually my goal to spend my retirement here. I started participating in the work group meeting as a member of the public prior to me joining Storegga. I had heard about carbon capture and storage, and I was curious about its potential in Alaska. As being part of the team, I learned very quickly that Alaska is a prime candidate for carbon storage. The natural geology is very well suited, and I think the state has a long history. I'm confident the state has a long history of well-regulated and successful oil and gas operations. I was confident enough that there was a place for this in Alaska that I decided to unretire and devote time to making this a reality in our state. In summary, I'm confident that carbon storage projects can be done safely. Our state history with oil and gas has demonstrated that thoughtful regulation combined with agency oversight can and will enable safe operations. The last thing I'll say, and this is of great importance to me, I do believe that carbon storage could play a significant role in diversifying the future Alaskan economy. Thank you very much for allowing me to provide this statement.
Okay, thank you very much, John. Rep. Sadler has a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Hentges, you said you're testifying as a citizen, but you say you're also the Alaska Project Manager for Storegga and a member of the CCUS Working Group. Is there any place where your testimony as a citizen diverges from what your position might be in those other two capacities? It's just kind of confusing that you say you're speaking as a citizen when you're obviously closely involved in the project from a couple of standpoints.
I'm sorry for that confusion, and the answer is no. They're all lined up.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, John. Now we move on to Cassie Andrews. Cassie, can you hear me? Hello, Cassie? Okay, we'll wait for Cassie. In the meantime, I'd like
to... Can you hear me?
Oh, is she coming on? Okay. Hey, Cassie, can you hear me?
Hello. Yes, I can.
Okay, Cassie Andrews, please state your name and your affiliation and begin your three-minute testimony.
Yes, thank you for hearing me today. My name is Cassie Andrews, and I'm from Anchorage, and I'm representing myself. I oppose this legislation. Last Thursday, the 16th, I sent an email with an opinion piece regarding 45Q tax credit. This article cautions against the use of the tax credit. The response I received back from a member of this committee indicated that the state has nothing to do with the credit, that they're only setting up the framework to provide a storage solution, and that it wasn't clear what type of long-term damage I was referring to in my email. The first question I would have was, what actually happens when these credits run out? And there's also a little more to it than that, as the bill also modifies statutes to allow for CO2 pipelines, just as another example. We would not be proceeding with legislation if not for the tax credit. So, yes, the state does have something to do with it, as it is creating a framework that accepts the notion that there is an inherent value to carbon, in which, in fact, there's not. And that is the most important and basic fact about this whole thing. In a free market economy, things that humans need or want, countered by the available supply, establishes its monetary value. This is simply supply and demand economics. I do not hear any of the citizens asking for this. What I do see in here are bureaucrats and folks with ties to organizations like Arabella Advisors and the 1630 Fund, who, in their own words, are working to honor the Paris Agreement. They are praising this. And that should raise some serious red flags as to what that means for our oil and gas industry. We should be asking, what do they know about this that we don't? And are they out to destroy the lifeblood of our state? I believe the answer is yes. Look at what's happening with the Willow development. Did you know that a deciding factor for the Willow project's approval is based on the social cost of greenhouse gas emissions? This is a gross overreach in government regulation. One thing also worth noting is that the Alaska Independence Party voted unanimously to oppose this bill. To the point about not being sure about what the long-term damage is, where do we go from here? Once government and big business, also known as the public-private partnership, agree that CO2 has a monetary value, the next step is what has value becomes taxed by the government. Once the price has been established by the market for carbon, the people will become taxed on their usage of it. You see that this is already occurring in the previous reference of the social cost. Alaska is already losing, as the alternative of 3 drill sites as opposed to the original 5 is being determined solely on the social cost of carbon. What is the social cost of reduced energy to folks scraping by trying to heat their home? What about as it relates to national security? The problem is that this is not widely known, and that's blatantly obvious when you hear anyone presenting or supporting this plan say, this is not ESG. Thank you for hearing my testimony today.
Okay, Cassie, get the gold star for being right on time with 3 minutes. Thank you. Okay, we move on to Todd Lindley. Todd, can you hear me from Valdez?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir, Todd. Please state your name, your affiliation, and begin your three-minute testimony.
Yes, my name is Todd Lindley. I'm calling in today as a private citizen. I reside in Anchorage, but I'm currently down in Valdez for business. I'm calling in opposition. I do not support these bills. And they do not need to be brought to the table. They need to be tabled until a proper evaluation can be done.
Yeah, Mr. Lindley, I want to remind you we're discussing HB 50 only.
Yes, sir. That's clear. HB 50 should be tabled until there's a proper evaluation that can be done. When looking at these numbers, it makes no sense why any oil business would want to participate in this carbon storage and offset program. In addition to the base operating costs for oil facilities, now they have to add facilities, which will increase the cost on an order of magnitude of $50 to $120 per ton of CO2. including additional fees that have yet to be determined. It will require these businesses to meet the requirements of an exchange that is not accountable to this legislative body. The sustainable development goals are in conflict with the natural resource clause of the Constitution of the state of Alaska. One wants to reduce oil production to reduce emissions. The other wants to increase oil production and be responsible with the land. 87% of the state's tax revenue is on the line and will disappear if this bill is passed. Alaska will be left with nothing. My question is, who wrote these bills? It has been established that it has been studied extensively over by the state for all of 2022, no mention to the public. Why are we not commissioning a grand jury to look at the ties between these bills, Carlyle Group investment, of 50% of Prudhoe Bay assets and the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and conflicts of interest on the PFD board? A grand jury investigation can indict and subpoena to identify any collusion between the state and these entities for why the bills are being rushed through the committee. Thank you for letting me testify today.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lindley. Moving on to Lauren Hendricks. Lauren, can you hear me okay?
I can. Good afternoon.
Okay, Lauren, please state your name, your affiliation, and begin your three-minute testimony.
Will do. My name is Lauren Hendricks. I am a Director of Marketing and Proposals at ASRC Energy Services. I am calling to provide public testimony in support of HB 50. As a third-generation Alaskan, I hope that Alaska is staying at the forefront of making carbon capture safe and economical so Alaska can prosper for future generations. DNR has actively been engaging with the Carbon Capture Utilization and Storage, CCUS, working group of over 50 members, which has brought together state entities, private corporations, and even the university to discuss clear and safe paths forward. In addition, a consortium has even applied for the Direct Air Capture Hub funding that was recently released by the Department of Energy. The timing is important. I'm hoping HB 50 will give AOGCC the authority to pursue Class 6 primacy, which will enable faster and certain permitting. Alaskans' long-standing oil and gas industry and its workforce are very primed to implement Class 6 wells safely. Seizing these CCUS opportunities can make Alaska a leader in the field. This will make Alaska stand out amongst other states, and this will help Alaskans by creating jobs and boosting our economy. So I support HB 50, and thank you to all of those who have brought this bill forward. And this concludes my comments.
Okay, thank you, Lauren, very much. Now we move to Cara Moriarty. Cara, can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
I sure can, Cara. Please state your name, your affiliation, and begin your three-minute testimony.
All right, thank you. Chairman McKay, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Kara Moriarty, and I'm the president and CEO of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, as you know, commonly referred to as AOGAS. We represent the majority of oil and gas companies in the state, and our mission is to advocate for the long-term viability of the industry. AOGAS supports the advancement of the research, development, and demonstration of carbon capture, utilization, and storage, commonly referred to as CCUS. We agree with Governor Dunleavy. Alaska is uniquely positioned to be a leader in this industry. Many of our members, as you have likely seen in past presentations to the committee, have net zero goals that they are working to achieve. In and all of the above energy environments like Alaska, CCUS and oil and gas development are not mutually exclusive. We appreciate the governor being innovative and working to capitalize on this fast-growing industry. We support CCUS public policies that support technology research, development, and demonstration, recognize the range of carbon mitigation technologies, provide operators with the choice to deploy CCUS, establish a competitive pricing environment that encourages investment, recognize market-based solutions in a variety of methods, allow the deployment to be counted as avoided emissions toward net zero goals, encourage new carbon capture facilities and support infrastructure, address the long-term storage of CO2 to reflect the division of public and private responsibility, and encourage consistency. I apologize for the background noise behind me all of a sudden. We appreciate the administration's efforts to engage with industry early and often on this topic as we are learning more about these opportunities. With respect to the bill specifically, we are supportive of the general framework the bill is working to establish. We understand legislation is a work in progress, and there is more learning ahead, and we look forward to continued engagement and learning as this bill works through the process. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Cara. I have a question, Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Chair McCabe. So, Cara, it's Representative McCabe. Maybe you mentioned that there were some of your members that are being required by their boards or they want to participate in carbon storage or carbon ESG stuff, if you will. Can you give me an idea of how many of them there are, and also if we don't provide a place for them to sort of store their carbon, what will they do then? Ship it out of state, I suppose, at great expense? Thanks.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I don't know exactly how many of my member companies have net zero targets or other ESG principles off the top of my head. I can get back to the committee and supply that information. But regardless, I mean, as you said, you know, this is something that, you know, our companies are working on in other states, many of them, and they are focusing on a variety of goals, kind of depending on who they are and where they operate. And so, you know, as I said in the testimony, if you look at what's happening in other states, Wyoming and North Dakota have already adopted this framework and projects are underway in those states as we speak. There's, I think, two or three other states that are a little bit ahead of us. They don't have the full regulatory framework yet, but, I mean, one could argue that Alaska is actually a little behind in trying to establish this opportunity here, and so we do encourage the committee to take a good look at this bill. We appreciate the time and attention that you've already spent, because I do think it is important for Alaska to get in the game, if you will, to provide these opportunities here locally, because it's happening. And as I said, there's some other states that are already ahead of us in that realm.
Thanks, Kara.
Okay, Rep. Sadler has a question, Kara.
Thank you. To the chair, Ms. Moriarty. We actually have heard from a couple folks earlier today expressing a concern that should this program go through in Alaska, that the taxpayers might end up paying a cost or bearing a burden. I'm not sure, other than the oil industry, largely other corporations in Alaska, the individuals don't pay taxes, so taxpayers would be in the oil industry. In your surveillance of this issue around the country, have you seen any situations in which taxpayers or the oil companies have ended up paying the price to support the carbon capture and storage system?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, to my knowledge, I'm not aware of anything. I can get back to you and follow up. The American Petroleum Institute has a really good slide deck that I can provide that gives a status of what's happening in other states, and I think it includes that portion of it. And I'd be happy to get back to you on that.
Okay, thank you, Carr. It sounds like you're shoveling off your roof.
I wish. I'm actually, in full disclosure, I'm at the Denina Center, and they started to set up behind me after Senator Murkowski's luncheon. So okay. I really do apologize.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Moving on, Mr. Frank Paskvan. Frank, can you hear me?
Yes, and thank you, Chairman McKay and committee members. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, Frank. Please state your name, your affiliation, and begin your three-minute testimony.
My name is Frank Paskvan. I'm born and raised Alaskan, born in Fairbanks and living in Anchorage now. I've worked in 36 years in the oil and gas industry and stayed in Alaska when my company left the state.
I am now affiliated as a professor for carbon capture use and storage with the University of Alaska Fairbanks Institute of Northern Engineering. And as some of the others have mentioned, I lead the Alaska State Work Group that's working on carbon capture use and storage. I'm calling in support of HB 50 and wanted to share that our work group was formed in July of 2022 with the purpose to accelerate commercial carbon capture use and storage projects in the state. We want to attract new investments and to assure continued operations of power generation, industrial processes, and oil and gas production, all of which are carbon-intensive activities vital to the state economy. We're not seeking state funding for carbon capture projects. We're seeking a legal and regulatory framework to allow businesses and industry to thrive. Speaking about our work group, it has diverse representation, half from industry, one quarter from state agencies, one eighth from the university, and one eighth from federal non-government organizations and public representation. We've had 110 attendees. We meet up to two times a month with up to 50 members. And the University of Alaska Fairbanks has a lead role. And my co-leadership includes representation from academia, industry, and government. So this work group was used as a platform ahead of the drafting of this bill to get diverse input on the legal and regulatory framework and policies and issues. We held four work group meetings in August to provide input, and one of those meetings was a whole day work session. It was very interactive. There was extensive note taking, including seeking of non-consensus opinions to make sure all voices were heard. We have a white paper that summarizes this that's published at a UAF website, ine.uaf.edu/carbon. And the DNR, AOGCC, ADEC, other state agencies, and various industry, NGO, and public representation was there. This was also reviewed at the corporate section of the Alaska Bar Association in a working group lunch. In the work group, we are seeing broad support for establishing a legal and regulatory framework and a desire to signal that Alaska is open for business. The carbon capture industry is rapidly expanding, and it's important to become a first mover. And that's why the work group is supporting carbon storage bill and look forward to its passage.
Okay, Mr. Passman, I have to stop you there in fairness. Representative McCabe has a question for you.
Yes, sir. So thanks. Through the chair, I mean, maybe you're the best person to ask this. I understand that the North Slope, the oil industry up there and the drilling up there produces, it seems to me, was 10 million tons maybe of CO2 from a couple test or a couple days ago. So with their idea that, and I've read some of them where they say that they want to be net zero, they want to be carbon neutral, with their desire to do this, and maybe the working group already heard this, if we can't provide storage up there for it, are they going to spend the money that it takes to barge all of the carbon out of there to somebody that will provide storage for them?
Well, I can't speak for all those companies, but that's what's going on in other states in the lower 48. For example, there's ethanol plants in like Iowa and stuff. They're making ethanol from corn, and that process generates CO2. And there are locations that don't have the regulatory framework in place, the legal pore space ownership and all those. That's not been established. So they're pipelining it cross country to places like North Dakota, which have established injection sites to safely sequester the CO2. So people are doing that now. They're transporting it intrastate or interstate. What would happen in Alaska? I I would hate to see the economics on that. I think it'd be pretty expensive.
Thank you.
Well, I feel like I should clarify. This is Chair McKay. You know, on North Slope, the gas is considered stranded. There's no market for it, so it has to be reinjected into the reservoirs that are currently active. So HB 50 really doesn't change the operation very much. It just requires the CO2, which is non-toxic, to be injected into Class 6 wells into reservoirs that are already depleted. Okay, so we'll move on. Thank you, Mr. Passman, for your testimony. Mr. Brett Huber. Brett, can you hear me?
Hi, my name is Bert Huffgilling. I'm from Big Lake. I'm testifying for myself, my child, and about 5,000 other Alaskans.
Okay, hold on a minute. Bert, I'm sorry. I had you out of order. I apologize. Zach, hold on, Bert.
Okay.
Want me to go to Bert? Okay. Okay, Bert, I'm sorry. Bert had you out of order here on my screen. So please state your name, your affiliation, and begin your three-minute testimony.
Hi, my name is Bert Huffgilling. I am out of Big Lake. I represent myself, my child, and about 5,000 Alaskans that like to listen to what I have to say about what's happening in Alaska. I am for carbon capture, as in you're describing taking what is coming out there in the North Slope and repumping it right back down into the ground. But I'm not for anything that's going to cause more regulations to stop the growth of developing of our resources. The Constitution of Alaska says that we are supposed to maximize all resources that we have within our state to the maximum potential for all Alaskans. This bill, to me, sounds more like another regulation that's going to stifle growth and make it even harder for them to do. The companion bill that you have there for HB 49 for paying for carbon credits for places like California to pollute.
Yeah, Bert, okay, we're going to stick to HB 50. We're only talking about HB 50 today.
Okay, well, they kind of go hand in hand. There is no real separation.
Yes, there's a huge separation, Bert. There's a huge separation, and we're only going to talk about HB 50.
Okay, well, then I'm not for this bill. We'll just leave it at that, since I'm not allowed to give my public testimony as I am should be allowed to do without interruption.
Mr. Bert Huffling, you will have a chance to talk about HB 49 later. There are two separate bills. There's no relationship between the two, and thank you for your testimony. Zach, who you want me to go to?
Brett.
Okay, Mr. Brett Huber, are you on the line? Can you hear me, Brett?
I am, Mr. Chairman, but I am only participating today should the committee have questions for me. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Brett. That's why we didn't have him. Okay, and George is just listening, too. Okay. Okay. Okay, next up, Christine Ressler. Christine, can you hear me okay?
This is Christine Ressler. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can, Christine. Please state your name, your affiliation, and begin your three-minute testimony.
Thank you. My name is Christine Ressler. I am the CEO of ASRC Energy Services. I'm in favor of House Bill 50, and as has been mentioned by a number of my peers, I am on the working group that has been working very hard over the last several months to support DNR in getting this legislation drafted. Many people have said things that I had planned to say, and so I thought I would step back and think through some of the things that we haven't heard. So what is carbon capture? Keeping it really simple, what we're suggesting is you take streams of carbon, you put technology on it to capture that carbon, move it either short or long distances, hopefully short because it's less expensive that way. I know a number of folks have asked about barging and long pipelines, and then reinject it into the ground for permanent storage. A Class 6 well, as you've heard us refer to, is the EPA's classification for a well that is allowed to have this type of injection done and performed on it. So why did our state do this, and why have we supported this bill? At the end of the day, we are a state that has a lot of fossil fuels, coal, oil, natural gas, And this is a way to keep those fossil fuels competitive, and it's a way to keep our state competitive and to keep the economic engines and the overall economy of our state strong. There is no reason to believe that this bill is going to cause any ancillary taxes. And as Kara mentioned earlier, to the best of our knowledge, there is no other state in the U.S. where that has ultimately come to pass. Alaska has the ability to be on the forefront of this, maybe not the first mover, because I think Wyoming and North Dakota has already taken that status, but certainly in the top quartile. And I think it's really important that we do everything we can to support our industry. And I would like to thank the state of Alaska and our government for being so proactive in proposing this bill. When the infrastructure bill was passed in the fall of 2021, a group of us started working and realizing the opportunities for storage, the future of our fossil fuel industry across the state. And we submitted a document to the U.S. Department of Energy about the capabilities and strengths and opportunities that Alaska had as it related to carbon capture and storage. Subsequently, as a couple of folks have mentioned, a group of us have put together a consortium that is applying for and just submitted a letter of intent to apply to be a direct air capture hub and get funding from the Department of Energy. Those things likely will not happen if we are not a state that has legislation around regulating carbon injection and Class VI soil primacy. And so I just want to make sure the legislature knows how important this is to the future of our industry and thank the state for their willingness to take this on and help our state.
Okay, thank you, Christine. Rep. Sadler has a question.
Thank you, to the Chair, Ms. Ressler. From your perspective as ASCS's CEO, you might be well positioned to answer this question. Specifically, we've heard a couple generalities about how HB 50 might help the oil industry. Specifically, can you list a couple ways in which this bill would benefit your company and others in the industry?
Well, I think it best benefits the industry because it potentially gives us the ability to lower our carbon footprint. And so, you know, I don't have a crystal ball, but there is the potential that that's going to be important to us in the future. And so if we've got the regulatory framework in place to be able to lower our carbon footprint and to be able to produce lower carbon fossil energy, I think that's just a good thing for the state of Alaska and for all of the different players that are a part of the broader industry.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, thank you, Christine, so much for your testimony today. Now we move on to Vicki Jo Kennedy from Juneau. Vicki Jo, can you hear me okay?
I can. I'm Vicki Jo Kennedy.
Okay.
I'm currently still in Juneau for the past 4.5 years, and I'm here representing myself.
Okay.
And the cat.
Okay. Please begin your testimony, Vicki Jo.
Okay, thank you. Hey, first of all, that open for business is a great motto. It was poached from West by God, Virginia, because they've had it since 2004. I was there. Now, I'm not sure where I'm going to be honest, where I'm standing with this. I'm listening. I always listen. And there's so many educated people on both sides. But I guess I'm a little perplexed about, we have a tundra. We have a big tundra. And it is emitting not just carbon, but, oh, God, I just dropped it. You have to excuse me. I've had a concussion, and I'm forgetting some things. But it emits an awful lot of that gas. And how are we going to supply a capturing system when we're putting off at the rate the tundra is emitting it? How is that going to work? I mean, where's the balance going to be? Who's going to capture ours? You know, but I'm listening. I have faith in you guys and gals there at the legislature to listen to all of this. And I'm just really not ready to say whether I support this bill or not. But like I say, I'm interested. I think it says a lot, but I want to know how we're going to balance it out. How are we going to be able to do that? You know, everything on this planet is carbon-based. Well, except for cephalopods. That'd be your octopus, you know, your squid, your cuttlefish, that kind of thing.
Okay, Vicki Jo, thank you very much for your testimony. You've This is Chairman Tom McKay. You're welcome to call my office anytime, and I'll have my staff answer all your questions.
You're a gentleman and a scholar. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Vicki Jo. God bless you. Okay. I think that concludes everyone that's online. Now, I have Craig Wilson and Liam Zolt. Are you on the list to testify? Liam, did you want to testify?
I would.
Okay. So, Liam, would you come forward to the table, state your name and your affiliation, and begin your testimony?
Sure. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Liam Zolt. I'm the Director of Innovation and Technology Development for ASRC Energy Services, and I sit on the board of the Alaska Industry Support Alliance, but I am testifying on behalf of myself alone today, but about a subject that I'm extremely excited about. Carbon capture and underground storage. Firstly, thank you to the DNR for putting together such a great bill. I know a lot of work went into this. There's been a lot of talk on the phone today about the group of companies and legislators agencies in Alaska and the university that have really worked with the DNR together to put this in play, and I think it's great. I want to really focus today on some of the stuff that we've heard about whether carbon capture and storage has any value, because I don't think that that's really what this bill is about. People have talked about the 45Q tax credits. That's a federal program. People have talked about whether greenhouse gas emissions and climate change are real. I think that that's completely outside of the scope of this bill. The scope of this bill is to put in place regulations that enable us to build what could be a part of the future economy of Alaska. The reality is, as a lot of people on the phone have alluded to today, that the oil and gas companies and their customers in Alaska, they care about the carbon footprint. They really care about the carbon footprint of the hydrocarbons that they produce. And people in the future are going to become more and more interested in the carbon footprint of their fuels and all the products in their lives. So the oil and gas companies are going to, in the current state and in the future state, look for ways that they can offset those emissions and look for places where they can produce them in a low carbon way. So I don't think these things are against each other or mutually exclusive at all. I think that we promote a healthy and sustainable oil and gas industry in Alaska by enabling these companies to put that tool in their toolbox and allow them to do carbon capture and storage if it makes sense. Remember, 45Q is not Alaska level. It's a federal thing, but a lot of these companies are responding to regulatory frameworks that are either outside of the U.S., or it's a voluntary offset market. There's all kinds of ways that people find value in lowering the carbon of fuels. And I think that we would be remiss if we didn't enable them to do that so that we can stay on the edge of innovation in Alaska as we always have. So thanks to the hard work of the consortium is the word I was looking for earlier. I'm sorry, for putting all this together, and to the DNR for such a great presentation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Zolt. Representative McCabe has a question for you. So,
thanks, Mr. Zolt, and through the chair. So, you seem to be involved with the entities that are putting together this framework, which is really what it is a beginning. It's a framework, and it would be a shame to shut a framework down at the very start before we really have a chance to explore it. But I'm curious. In the last couple of years, we've read where major banks, hedge funds, retirement funds won't invest in Alaska oil or on the North Slope because of the carbon footprint of the oil and gas industry up there. So would you say, in your opinion, that this is the industry's attempt to make themselves more attractive to those folks that are maybe suddenly not interested for one reason or another, whatever the reason is, in investing in their projects on the slope?
I couldn't speak to what their strategy is. You know, those are not tables that I personally sit at. But what I would say is this could work fabulously to that end. The hydrocarbon producers in Alaska, if they are able to offset those emissions in Alaska and lucidly describe the carbon footprint of their products, then yeah, that certainly gives them a much better position when they sit down with the banks and with the people who would see the investment not come to Alaska. And I'm excited to enable them to do that.
Thank you.
Okay. So I'll just add another comment to my colleague from Big Lake. This is Chair Tom McKay, that from everything I know about the industry and the North Slope operation, it's almost essential that we have a carbon storage capability in some form if we're ever going to have a gas pipeline to Cook Inlet, because they'll have to strip out the CO2 and it's going to have to go somewhere. Mm-hmm. So if we ever want to have a gas pipeline, we may have to do HB 50. Rep Sadler, you had a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Zolt, I appreciate your coming to us from your position at SEC and the Alliance Board as well. So my question is kind of to be devil's advocate. What is, if we were to pass this bill, what is the worst that could happen? What are we exposing ourselves to risk-wise from your perspective as someone involved in the industry? What's the downside? What's the risk we might be taking?
One of the reasons that I'm so passionate about this is I see very, very little downside to this bill. The Class 6 program is an extremely robust way of looking at the safety and the ability of wells to be able to continue to contain carbon dioxide in the future. So I think that to the extent that people would see that as a risk in the proliferation of CO2 capture and storage, I don't see it. We're not forcing anyone to do anything. We're just creating the regulatory environment that allows us to build these businesses here in the States. Or in the state.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Zolt? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Zolt, for your testimony and answering our questions.
Thank you so much.
Is there anyone else wishing to testify publicly? I will now close public testimony, seeing none. And I will take a brief at ease while we set up for our presentation from our consultant. Okay, we're back on the record, and we're going to go to our presentation today. We're joined today by another of the governor's consultants working on the issue of carbon storage. Mr. Craig Wilson with Stantec is back in Juneau for us today. I think you probably spent the weekend here.
I live here.
Oh, you live here. Well, then, it was not a big deal then. Thanks for being back with us, Craig, and thank you for your patience. And please say your name and your affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Sure. My name is Craig Wilson. I'm with Stantec Consulting. We've been retained by the Alaska Department of Natural Resources as a consultant to help them out with CCUS issues. Today I'll give you a brief overview of some of the work we've done for them regarding looking at pure state review of how other states are handling CCUS legislation. As you've probably heard and know already, CCUS, it's still a work in progress in most states. It's relatively new. It really started back in 2009, 2010 when the EPA came out with a Class 6 UIC program. And most states have developed some sort of legislation to support that, either to support primacy or to allow the EPA permitting within the state. It's really picked up in the last few years, primarily due to the increase in the 45Q tax credits. 2021 increased the credits considerably and also extended the deadline. As I can see, we've got 11 states that have some form of CCUS legislation. They vary widely in the range. Wyoming and North Dakota have the most complete set, primarily because they're the two states that currently have Class 6 primacy. We also, because of the Alaska is a little unique in that the State Lands Act, Statehood Act, gives the state of Alaska ownership of the mineral estate, which is different than the lower 48. And in some sense, Alaska's position is much closer to a foreign state, either like Alberta or, you know, Canada, Norway, UK, something like that, where the crown or the state, the sovereign state, has ownership of the pore space. So we also looked at a few, five foreign states. And my apologies if this is a complex little chart here. But in review, you find that there's a lot of, there's a several common themes that come out. Legislation in other states, you have your basic statutory purpose and regulation, establishment of authority, who's going to, you know, what state agencies are going to oversee the regulations. Resource designation, this is who owns the pore space, who owns the CO2 after it's been injected in the ground, unitization, amalgamation, primacy of subsurface rights. You know, these are topics that you've already been other folks have already spoken to. There's a fiscal support. Every state has some sort of, they generally have two funds. One is an operating fund to cover the cost of permitting, oversight of the program, and then they'll have some sort of a long-term trust fund to cover the financial liabilities for long-term liability. And, of course, they'll all have some sort of a permitting process. They generally, in order to meet EPA requirements, have some sort of environmental consideration, environmental justice, public participation type activities. And just the standard operations, such as monitoring and verification of the injection, that sort of thing.
I should probably pause for questions. Yep. Craig, any questions on Rep. Armstrong?
Sorry if this is a little bit too soon, but I'm curious. I love this chart. Through the chair. Out of all of these states, are any of them currently making profits from this? And out of the ones that aren't profitable yet, how much has it cost those states to date? Is that information that you looked at in your state
report? We did not look directly through the chair. We did not look directly at the profit, the budgets of those states. Generally, the permitting requirements are handled not at the legislative level, but at the regulation level by the individual agencies, and they are typically set to cover their costs or some portion of them. The long-term liability funds, none of them have gotten into use yet, since this is a very, fairly new activity. Some of the states do have caps on the sum of the funds. total amount. A lot of it is dependent upon when and if the state accepts liability for the stored CO2. It varied quite a bit. You can go from, I think it was West Virginia is planning on taking state liability for the stored CO2 immediately upon closure of the facility. Other states do 10 years, 20 years. EPA on the federal level has a 50-year liability, and then Kansas accepts no liability. So there's a wide range. I think the takeaway is CCUS legislation is still in its infancy. It is not evolved to a cookie cutter, you know, here's the program. Most states that are looking for primacy are looking towards Wyoming and North Dakota because they've been successful at getting it. And so that is generally the model that they're working off of. That's where, you know, Texas is looking at that. Arizona is looking at it that way. West Virginia is taking a slightly different tack, but generally is following that.
Okay.
Follow up.
Okay.
Sure.
Through the chair. Has Wyoming or North Dakota shared anything about the cost or profits or their projections or economic modeling or any of that?
Through the chair, no.
Follow up.
Okay.
Sorry, we have such a precarious fiscal climate, and whether this is going to cost us a lot of money or make us a lot of money feels really important. I'm just curious if you were able to point me in the direction of how to understand which bucket we might fall in and what that might look like long term. Easy question.
Yeah. The methods, the funding for these programs varies a lot. You're looking at, you have permitting fees, you have licensing fees, you have rental of the surface estate, you have injection fees, and they all vary significantly. It's the mix and match. I think Alaska is not unique in that the legislatures are looking to minimize the cost or have it revenue neutral. But, I mean, North Dakota got their primacy in, I want to say, 2018, and Wyoming 2020. So it's too early to tell whether this, you know, we're still in the very early stages.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay. Okay, Rep. Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Wilson, you mentioned offhand that the EPA had a 50-year timeline for liability. And just curious, how does that 50-year time frame overlap with what the state of Alaska, 10 years, and then it's our responsibility? Just, and is there an EPA standard we have to meet that will exist for 50 years?
Through the chair, the short answer is no. The longer answer is when EPA came out with the Class 6 permit program in 2009-2010, there was a lot of discussion about long-term liability. I mean, as you've heard from other presenters, we're talking about injecting carbon dioxide underground forever. And if you go to the potential liabilities, even if the risk is small, if you're talking about an extremely long time frame, the EPA kind of, they hedged the issue after discussion with industry and such. They came up with they said, you're liable for the CO2 for 50 years. However, they have this little caveat on it that says, your liabilities under CERCLA or RCRA do not end.
Huh. Cradle to grave.
Yeah,
it's the cradle to grave and, you know, joint and several liability. Under EPA's defined CO2 that comes from an industrial process as an industrial waste product. And so, therefore, RCRA applies.
And to the point, if I could probe that. So
follow up?
The legislation, I believe, envisions the state of Alaska taking over liability after the 10-year process. Would that obligation under RCRA remain with the original producer of the CO2, or would it devolve to the state of Alaska in perpetuity?
That would be, to the chair, that would be a question for lawyers.
Fair enough. Okay.
Sure. I don't even want to go down that rabbit hole.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Wilson. I just want to ask on this chart, of course, obviously, it's a lot of information on here. All these eight peer states, and you may not know the answer to this, but do any of them lease state land for this purpose anywhere? Or are all the mineral rights to all, on all these eight states held privately? Is there anything we can look to, you know, that's like us?
Chairman McKay, yes. Texas has what they call this, I'm going to screw this up, but it's a school board trust, I believe, something along that lines. They have public lands that are utilized to fund their education system, and they are leasing those lands out for CCUS. I believe okay. Some of the parishes in Louisiana also. So there is state land that is being used, yes.
Good. Okay. Did we look at those regulations, or maybe we should look at those regulations just to get an idea of how those two states are, you know, certainly operating that particular situation?
Our survey did not look at that specific.
Okay.
However, we did, you know, Texas and Louisiana are included in the survey. They're in the report.
Okay, thank you. Please continue.
So just to give you an example of what a program would look like, here's a lovely little chart from Wyoming of just what it takes to permit a Class 6 well. I think a lot of folks, and maybe this is a good place to put it, the difference between a Class 2 and a Class 6 well. You know, Class 2 wells, State of Alaska already has primacy for Class 2 UIC program. It's handled by the AOGCC. It's commonly used up on the slope already. This is where you're injecting hydrocarbons back into a reservoir for enhanced oil recovery. CO2 works very well. As you've heard, it's a supercritical fluid down at depth. It works as a very good sweep, especially when you alternate CO2 and water. You can increase the recovery rate of your oil field quite a bit. And the one of the part of the reasoning behind the class two is there's the expectation you're pumping the CO2 back and down hole. Eventually, some of it's going to come back up with produced fluid in the wellbore. Whereas a class six, the purpose is to put it down there forever. So the class six permitting process is much more robust. There's a lot more modeling involved. There's a lot more looking at offsite consequences, a lot more liabilities inserted. So you need to, I think it's a good takeaway is, although you have both class two and class six where you're injecting carbon dioxide, they're for different purposes and have significantly different requirements.
Okay, please continue.
And I'll just keep going on the UIC, I guess. I know there's been some questions in the last week or so, just what it all takes. Just for your background, the underground injection control comes out of the Safe Drinking Water Act. And so all the CO2 class well, class two, class six wells, their primary purpose on the federal side is protection of underground drinking water aquifers. So that's the regulatory driver. That's the legislative driver on the federal side. The classes one through five were developed in mid-80s, mid-90s. And the program was developed so that states could take over primacy of many of these. And you can look up the chart. You've got some states just did class one, class two. Some states did class one through five primacy. As I've said, and as you're aware, you have two states, North Dakota and Wyoming, that now have primacy for class 1 through 6.
Rep. Armstrong had a question.
Sure.
Thank you, through the chair. Is there any possibility, like with an earthquake or something else, that it could impact drinking water just because of the way the ground
That's is? Part of the modeling involved, that the requirement is you basically identify the reservoir, show that it has sufficient geologic traps, that it's sufficiently distant away from an underground drinking water or potential underground drinking water aquifer, and that the CO2 will stay there despite, given potential impacts from geological movement, earthquakes, future industrial activities, that it won't migrate off. And as you saw last week, that we had that one slide up there where you had a little point source, a well, surface footprint of 3/4 or an acre or something like that. But the underground footprint, the pore space footprint, was tens of square miles. CO2 is a supercritical liquid at depth, and it will flow with nearly friction-free. And so the biggest issue is, off-site consequences. Having said that, you also need to remember, as the chair has said, CO2, it's not a toxic material. The issues that arise from CO2 getting into a drinking water aquifer is basically you're getting carbonic acid, which some of you drank probably earlier today in the form of soda. Or maybe a gin and tonic last night. But the issue that comes out of that is if you're acidifying, if you're lowering the pH of your drinking water, then you have a potential of leaching metals out. That's the major offsite concern in terms of drinking water.
Thank you.
And I think it has to be mentioned that the one good thing about the North Slope is there's no freshwater drinking aquifers because it's permafrost.
Yeah.
So that really becomes a non-factor. Now, Cook Inlet, that's a little bit different. But on the slope, you get almost all permafrost. Rep. Sadler, you had a question?
Thank you. I do, through the chair, Mr. Wilson. I'm not sure if you're an engineer. I'm not sure if this is a good question to ask of you, but I see a slide up there with wells. So I'm going to ask the question. For enhanced oil recovery, there's a continual process of injecting CO2. I assume there's more than one cycle of injection.
Yeah.
Versus class 6, I think it's envisioned you keep pumping it down until you're done, then you're done. So two questions. One is the class 2 well therefore much more expensive because it's got to do more, it's got to be more activity? And is the mineralogy, metallurgy rather, and the design of the class 2 well versus class 6 well the same? I heard that the CO2 is corrosive. You have to have chrome tubes and so forth. Is that the same requirement on class 2 wells as in class 6 wells?
Chair's nodding his head, shaking his head. Through the chair, Representative Sadler. No, I'm not an engineer. Sorry. I work for an engineering firm, and I have engineers working for me.
But very good.
I'm not an engineer. What I can say is that a class 2 well, typically, if you're using carbon dioxide as an EOR fluid, you pulse it. And you do CO2, and then you do a water flood, then you do CO2, and that works better. That's more efficient than doing it's just straight CO2. And you're correct, on a class 6 well, you're basically just pumping it down until you've reached the maximum storage capacity of your permit, and then you shut down.
Okay.
It's probably not. I was probably incorrect. I mean, if there is CO2 in your fluid that you're injecting or producing, it can corrode, Rep. Sadler, and you typically would run more expensive tubulars like chrome type tubulars that are way more resistant to that type of corrosion. Okay. Class 6 well, I would expect, would have to be pretty well armored in that regard, because you're, you know, that's the sole purpose, is that it's seeing, you know, it's seeing the full concentration of CO2 constantly. So that's how that would work in an engineering sense. Okay, other questions on that slide? Okay, please continue.
Sure. I think that's pretty much it for slides.
Okay.
I'm trying not to. The takeaways that I would give you is that one of the other items is if the state of Alaska wants to get into carbon sequestration, geologic, one of the first steps is getting Class 6 primacy. That's an important step. It takes, there's four phases to it. It takes some time. This HB 50 is the first step by authorizing AOGCC to seek primacy. In terms of time frames, you're probably looking at minimum of 2 years. Other states, I think Wyoming took 5 years. North Dakota, I think they spent almost 8. Texas is getting really close there at the 3.5 year mark, something like that. So time is of the essence.
Now, that's not to say that you couldn't get a Class 6 well permitted through the EPA, but we would prefer to do it ourselves. But, I mean, in truth, right?
Correct. You could, someone could go today and work on a class, get an EPA Class 6 permit. As other folks have said, since EPA put in the program in 2010, they have permitted 2 wells. Both Archer Daniels, Midland, and Illinois. They currently have 33 permits pending. So, as I said, it's, you know, for the first 10 years of the permit program, there's been little interest in it. It's only with the increase of the carbon credits and the increase in state legislative, you know, goals of carbon neutral futures, state or corporate ESG targets, that you're starting to see a lot more interest in Class 6.
So, Rep. Sadler, do you have a question?
Then I could. Thank you. That point, I guess I want to cross the T here. So should we, through the chair, Mr. Wilson, should we presume, therefore, that Alaska should not rely on the standard, on the process of trying to get a Class 6 permit through EPA unless and until we get primacy? Is that just kind of a fond wish that would take too long?
Through the chair. Now, I mean, an oil company or any company could submit a permit, a Class 6 permit, to the EPA for place in Alaska right now. Because right now, the EPA has primacy for Class 6 permitting in Alaska. Having said that, the practical realities are that if the state had its own Class 6 program now, it would probably be faster.
Right.
The analogy you would get is, I don't know if you were around, 15 years ago when the state achieved primacy for the EPA's National Pollution Discharge Elimination System. We went from the NPDES permits to the APDES permits, and ADEC took over that. And the same issues that were involved with that would be involved with this, that you have local control of the permits, and the idea being that you'd have the state would be more responsive than EPA Region 10.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Wilson. Now, I know we want to wrap up here, but I think it's important while we're all together, a couple more questions that I have to just kind of clarify. The program that we're looking at under HB 50 is a voluntary program. from my understanding, we are not mandating that any oil and gas company in Alaska must do this. It's voluntary, which I think is vastly different than I think what they call cap and trade, which I think is in place in California, maybe Australia. Some of the testifiers earlier mentioned some of these other programs that, which HB 50 is not. And I thought I should stress that. And can you verify what?
Correct,
Mr. Wilson.
Correct, Chairman McKay. HB 50 sets up a framework so that if a industry wants to apply, they can do it. It sets up the framework. It does not mandate anything.
So the next question or statement I want to make, and you tell me if it's true, is the what's the IRS XP 50?
45Q.
Wow, I got it way mixed up. 45Q, if that just went away tomorrow, it could affect this program, but if the companies want to voluntarily do this, they may do it anyway.
Chairman McKay, they could. I think what we've found, you know, is that the economics don't make sense unless you've got the tax credits. That's the short answer. When the tax credits originally were put in place in 2008, and nothing happened for a long time, they were amended in 2018, and
but we may not be doing it based on economics. We may be doing it to be virtuous.
That is a possibility. If you're an oil company, what's the dollar side? How much dollars are you going to put for virtue?
We don't sit at those tables, so we don't know. But they could.
We don't.
But I guess what I'm trying to get at, HB 50 doesn't specifically rely on the federal tax credits.
Correct.
Okay, I'm just trying to be clear for, because I think there were some statements made during our session today that may not be accurate.
Correct.
Rep. Armstrong, you had a question.
Thank you, through the chair. So in our state, we adopt the federal tax code by reference, so folks would be getting the 45Q tax credit at the federal level and then at the state level, which you may have seen us discussing. Do other states offer additional tax incentives, or would they, if we end up exempting 45Q, would we be similar to other folks where we're not offering a tax incentive at the state level?
Through the chair, other states have generally given state-level tax credits. Either through reductions in property tax, through other carbon credits, production tax. It's varied quite a bit. You get someplace like California where you can write off almost everything. Other states, they generally have some sort of a property tax holiday for it.
Follow up.
Okay, follow up.
So no other states are offering 45Q exactly. They're coming up with their own mix of tax incentives separate from 45Q, not just copying and pasting that.
Through the chair, to the best of my knowledge, the other states have, additional add-on. You'd have to talk to a tax, someone who, the IRS could probably answer that. The whole 45Q, if you ever look into it, it's just the simple, the instructions for the form are 30 some odd pages of referencing other documents.
Thank you.
It's been amended so many times that it's spaghetti code.
Okay, well, we won't go there then. Rep. Sadler, one more question.
Thank you. Maybe two, maybe, if you're indulgent. So to get it through the chair, Mr. Wilson, to put a hard underline, so again, this is a voluntary program. If the state were to mandate carbon capture and storage, it would take separate legislation. We have to go through the whole process again and examine that issue. Is that correct? I want to answer the questions we heard during the public testimony.
Through the chair, that would be a more question for you guys. HB 50, as it currently stands, does not mandate anything. If the state were to mandate something, you'd have to come up with some additional legislation.
Very good. And follow up on a related topic, I guess. So, gee whiz. So, amendment is a separate link. So the state could, this is actually a statement to the chair, the state, if we wanted to offer any specific tax credit at the state level, then we'd have to also either have that as an amendment on this bill or separate legislation. And the bill right now does not envision anything like that. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct.
Okay, forget.
Okay, Rep. McCabe.
Thanks, Chair McCabe. So just a comment. I think it's typical of the federal government to put a 32 or 35 page tax credit bill in there and then not direct the EPA to relieve the primacy requirements for the wells that it takes to inject the CO2. So we're kind of forced to go down this to get class six primacy because the federal government didn't really complete what they should have done if they really wanted this carbon capture scheme or strategy to go through, if you will. So I guess I'll just leave it at that. I have a number of other questions that come from constituents, but at this point I think I'll save those for later.
Okay. Anything else? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Wilson, for sharing your expertise with us today. We will continue discussions with the administration about this bill during our next hearing. I will now set HB 50 aside. Is there any other business? Seeing none, the next committee meeting will be held at 1 o'clock on Wednesday, February 22nd. This meeting is adjourned at 2:30 p.m.